the United Presbyterian Church of South Africa. The document is 89. Is the church here? You must go where, I think if you could sit there, because normally people sit at that side. Eighty-nine honorable members. Do you have this next? Honorable quarters? Do you have a copy?
Yeah.
Eh? You got it? Oh, okay. Okay. You'll introduce yourself and then we proceed. Thank you very much. Sorry for keeping you waiting.
Good morning. I'm Reverend Matthew Tamboyan. I'm a minister from Andrews Presbyterian Church
and representing the Uniting Presbyterian Church in Southern Africa. Dear Chairperson, Members of Parliament, Ladies and Gentlemen, submission on the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act Amendment Bill B-72 of 2003. The Uniting Presbyterian Church in Southern Africa welcomes this opportunity to make a submission on the proposed legislation. As a way of introduction, the question of abortion is both a highly emotive and intricate one, involving the interests of the mother, the child, the father, the family, and the community. We as a church have wrestled with this issue for a number of years, but we realize that our stance has to be informed by both thorough research and the grace to apply the truth. At the 2006 General Assembly held at Livingstone, Zambia, we agreed on the following statement that would inform each response to issues affecting human life, and I quote, "Human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. From the first moment of his, her existence, a human being must be recognized as having the rights of a person, among which are the inviolable rights of every innocent being to life. It is therefore our duty and joy to communicate the value of all human life and to defend mothers, children and fathers, and even the health workers from all forms of abuse or injury. This submission should not in any way be interpreted as our acceptance of the present terms of the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act of 1996, but as a sincere attempt to inform the Provincial Health Committee hearing and limit further injury and abuse. We therefore take this opportunity to encourage the government of South Africa to use the considerable resources of the state to improve the lives of its citizens and express its benevolence to all members of our nation. Concerns regarding the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act Amendment Bill 2003. Just legislation must be unambiguous, clearly interpreted and enforceable, and the amendment bill raises several concerns, which I'll do now. There are seven concerns. Counselling and informed consent. Adequate counselling as to the significant health risks and complications associated with undergoing an abortion is not taking place presently. A number of women are now suffering the consequences of abortions and were not given enough information with which to make an informed choice. Some women have died whilst undergoing legal abortions. It has been pointed out that immunocompromised women are more susceptible to infections and complications arising from the surgical intrusion of an abortion and would generally be healthier and less vulnerable to infection if they had been allowed to give birth to the child naturally at full term. We are dealing pastorally with a number of women suffering from a psychological condition widely known as post-abortion syndrome. The women involved were not informed of the possibility of psychological suffering after an abortion. In recent research, a pro-choice professor David Ferguson described abortion as a traumatic life event. That is, it involves loss, it involves grief, and it involves difficulties. And the trauma may in fact predispose people to having mental illness. Abortion has conclusively been linked with several diseases, yet the amendment bill makes no mention of the moral responsibility and legal accountability of abortion practitioners to fully inform their patients. For example, the rupture of the uterus is listed as one of the more common and potentially life-threatening injuries experienced in a legal abortion. The post-abortion woman and post-abortion fathers will soon be asking for justice and compensation, just as tobacco companies and mines have had to pay for the consequences of their neglect. There is evidence that tobacco companies deliberately suppressed information and medical research that demonstrated the link between smoking and several diseases. In future court cases, this very document could be cited as an example to demonstrate that the government was sufficiently informed of the risks and dangers of its abortion legislation and practices. The question is the government making provision for the financial and legal implications of its deliberate actions? The amendment bill offers us an opportunity to fix accountability to the specific practitioners. We believe this oversight needs attention. The second concern, the designation of facilities. It is noted that the amendment bill proposes a further relaxation of criteria and increases the expectation of the public that all institutions should provide abortion facilities, even if it is contrary to the institution's ethos. Abortions require specialized equipment and need the services of specialists. Please, we ask you, do not relax the original legislation. The third concern, relaxing of the qualifications required for persons practicing abortions. Firstly, there is the widening of the scope of practice for registered nurses to be initiating the abortions. It is noted that the amendment bill would permit a medical practitioner in consultation with a registered nurse to terminate a pregnancy after the 20th week, according to second paragraph of 1996 of the Termination of Pregnancy Act. The implications of this have not been discussed within the nursing profession itself. We would submit that registered nurses are not adequately trained or sufficiently informed to be able to give a reasonable and accurate diagnosis and prognosis as suggested in the original Act. Such a diagnosis requires the observation of signs and symptoms and the interpretation of results from sophisticated diagnostic equipment and ultrasound. These results are not always conclusive. Given that both registered nurses and midwives are usually either in the employ of or under the direction and discipline of the medical practitioner making the initial judgment, they cannot easily give a truly unbiased and independent opinion. This is very serious, and this is a loophole and could lead to much abuse. Secondly, the term prescribed training course is too vague, and the prescribed training course is vulnerable to further adjustment and the erosion of curriculum standards. If the standards of this prescribed training course were lowered, they would further increase the exposure and risk to the health and safety of the mother and the abortion practitioner. What assurances does the amendment bill give the people of South Africa that this training course would cover competence in the emergency resuscitation of the mother and improve the levels of infection control? A high degree of training is required for surgical interventions, yet it is suggested that registered nurses are able to perform such practices. We are deeply concerned about this and advocate that you remove this clause from the amendment bill. The fourth concern, freedom of conscience clause. In every democracy, the rights of the people to make informed choices are protected. private and state medical institutions are applying more pressures on nurses and doctors to coerce them to perform abortions against their religious and ethical beliefs. These healthcare professionals are sometimes being discriminated against solely on the grounds of their refusal to perform abortions. The discrimination ranges from suggested disloyalty to the shareholders' profit motives of private healthcare institutions, to the suggestion of the contravention denial of the rights of a woman to have an abortion in a state institution, in the misuse of paragraph 10C, 1996. Sometimes these people have been denied promotion or transferred to other wards against their wishes. This is a form of persecution. It has been argued that the rights of such people are enshrined in the Constitution, but in practice, applications to the Constitutional Court for relief and protection require access to significant financial and legal resources. It is interesting to read in the Holy Bible in Exodus 1, verses 15 to 22, that the midwives, Sifra and Pua, were resisted, who resisted the attempts of Pharaoh to limit the strength of the nation of Israel, are mentioned by name. Such is the regard that God has for people who do what is right, whereas the Pharaoh's name is not known. It has been suggested that he is perhaps not worth mentioning. The proposed amendment bill does not offer any protection for health professionals to observe their convictions. This protection should be stipulated in the amendment bill. First concern, gestational age parameters. In the justification of an abortion in the second and third trimester of pregnancy, based on the grounds of severe physical or mental abnormality, severe malformation of the fetus, paragraph 2B and 2C of 1996 respectively. The terms severe physical or mental abnormality and severe malformation are too vague. When a term is not clear, it is exposed to wide interpretation. It is noted that in certain countries, the relatively minor cosmetic abnormality of a hair lip has been cited as an abnormality sufficiently serious to justify a legal abortion in the second and third term. The terms serious abnormality and severe malformation must therefore be defined in the amendment bill. Concern number 6, reporting. The legislated reporting of statistics is presently not being followed, paragraph 7.3 of 1996. Indeed, as you are aware, the government abortion statistics for 2006 are still not complete. No record is kept of abortion-related injuries and deaths sustained by mothers and health workers. The amendment bill should tighten up the responsibility and accountability for accurate record-keeping. Concern number 7, penalties and offences. We believe the stipulated penalties for the non-compliance in such important legislation are too light. Private institutions perform abortions for financial gain. We believe the financial attraction must be balanced by strict accountability and severe financial consequences in the case of non-compliance. The amendment bill offers an opportunity to address this. To conclude, the Uniting Presbyterian Church in Southern Africa is applying its efforts to translate its commitment to the sanctity of human life in providing viable alternatives to abortion. We are committed to dialogue and participation and hereby request an opportunity to present our views on the proposed amendment bill to Parliament. With this, albeit brief, exposure of the amendment bill to public comment, the government of South Africa now has what we could refer to as a Kairos moment. You have the opportunity to be remembered for bringing justice to our land, and we would encourage you to seize this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Reverend, for your presentation. We shall give an opportunity to members to ask questions. Thanks.
chapter 6. I'll let clarity from the referent on the following issues, because when we talk about human life,
shit off. Okay, if you tell me where.
When we talk about human life, Reverend, we talk about a life of a human being. I would like clarity on that one, because it's a human being who makes a decision, a human being who's, I can say in this term and to comply with you, who is alive, who makes a decision to choose to terminate a fetus, which each being a human life is open to a lot of controversies, because here a human life, as a human life was mentioned by the referent, is supposed to be a life of a person who is in a position, is according to me, to carry a fetus, and that human being is going to make a decision. So I don't know which life there is, to me the life on the constitution is of a person who's sitting there and making a choice whether to carry a fetus or not. And so that's why it's not clear.
Can I just guide the honorable members? I don't want us to enter into philosophical debates that we have actually engaged in the whole day yesterday about this question of human life.
Oh, I'm sorry,
we've had
I wasn't
a
there.
Full day discussion and then a number of experts giving us information around this question. Let's deal with what are the proposals that are being presented and how do we engage with those proposals. Otherwise, we can end up with a vicious cycle of boring repetition of submissions.
Oh.
As a chair, please bear with me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chairperson, because I missed the afternoon session.
Yes, that's why I'm guiding you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And the counseling to me, post-abortion counseling, and postnatal counseling, because we also have postnatal counseling for people who give normal birth. So, counseling. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chair. And one, I think we start by saying, the Bill of Rights is giving us a lot of our constitutional rights. One of those is in Section 16, freedom of speech. And many people around that right, they've the right to say what they want. But there are three speeches within that right that one need not to say. Number one is around propaganda. One need not to speak around propaganda issues, inciting people and what if you and what if you. Now, I just want to know from the presenter as to whether the idea of abortion, is it true as to whether this idea of breast cancer after abortion has been tested somewhere? There's been a research so far which says when a woman has undergone an abortion, ultimately she will develop a breast cancer. That is number one. And I just want to know again from the presenter, Chair, as to whether any other incident that can happen in one's life, for instance, it can be an accident, an operation or whatever, doesn't have any post whatever syndrome. That is number two. And lastly, she made mention of specialized equipment in her presentation. Can I have clarity around that as to which specialized treatments, which are expensive, that you have just referred to? Because yesterday we had a nurse, a doctor actually, who has presented to us and telling us that some of those equipment are cheap and very accessible. Thank you.
I'm wondering
Honourable members, thank you very much for your response. I have to be honest and open with you. We have had people research and put this paper together. I am submitting this paper and presenting this paper. So there are questions that you're asking that will be better answered by specialized people concerning the medical concerns and the recommendations for the submission. I think I clearly put after each point. So I want to keep to that.
But you will then be very much unfair to us, Reverend, because for us, we are dealing with you, who's representative of the presenters. And we expect you, and if you have got any other people who are supportive of your input, who are here, yes, then they can assist you, they are allowed to assist you. But we can't adjourn it beyond what you, because you are here to present to us. And therefore, our assumption, we take you as an expert on what you are saying. You can't be a conveyor of another expert's view and you come and present them to us here. It will be very much unfair to us. Honorable Dudley.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps if I can just follow up on something that was said yesterday and brought up again today. I have here a copy that I just want to hand to you of this 2007 article that was in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons, volume 12, to do with the breast cancer and the risk involved with abortion. Can I just pass this to you first? I was particularly interested in the observation that you made here. The post-abortion women and fathers will soon be asking for justice and compensation, just as tobacco companies and mines have had to pay for the consequences of their neglect. There is evidence that tobacco companies deliberately suppressed information and medical research that demonstrated the link between smoking and several diseases. And I'm understanding here that what you're suggesting is that we obviously may not see the danger now, but that in time to come we could be setting ourselves up for some serious court cases in the future. That was the one thing. What I would really just ask is a couple of... you didn't give exact wording of what you would like to see in the bill. So if I could ask you if certain wording would be in line with what you are saying. The suggestion that termination of pregnancy may take place only at a facility which has ultrasound equipment which must be used to accurately determine the gestation period prior to TOP and provide relevant information for the mother and to be able to give informed consent. Would you agree that that would be helpful in terms of what you've presented here? The other thing I wanted to ask was in terms of the counselling that you mentioned, would this wording perhaps line up with what you're suggesting? Under that same section, 3.1, putting in an I, gives access to counselling which is 1, mandatory, 2, provides full opportunity for discussion and questions, 3, provides sufficient information including electronic pictures, diagrams and photographs to enable the woman or child to understand the development of the unborn child, 4, includes discussion of the extent of the risks involved in continuing the pregnancy as set against the risks involved in terminating the pregnancy, including breast cancer, depression, and future difficulties in conceiving and bearing children. And 5, available alternatives to abortion, including adoption and state and other support available to the mother. Then there was just another section on the reporting. Would it help if we included under the Section 7 of the Principal Act, it reads, the person in charge of a facility referred to in Section 3 shall, within a month of the termination of a pregnancy at such facility, collate the prescribed information, including information regarding primary, secondary, and tertiary complications associated with prior TOP, and forward it by registered post confidentially to the relevant head. Because we would, I see that you were worried also about the capturing of previous problems. And then lastly, on the situation where we're talking about nurses and health professionals being under pressure, Section 10 of the Principal Act, would it help if we included these two sections? It's under the consequences. Any person who has an objection against rendering TOP services or against participating in TOP procedures or training on grounds of conscience based on compelling religious, ethical, or moral beliefs must not be discriminated against or compelled in any way to act against their conscience. And then clause 3. It is an offence to administer TOP without adequate proof that sufficient and relevant counselling has been given, enabling the person concerned to give informed consent. That would be my take on perhaps the wording in line with what you've said, and if you could just tell me if I'm on the right track or not.
Thank you. Can I speak?
Yes.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Yes. I think the purpose for submitting this paper is to focus on making a difference in the amendment bill. And thank you for that. It's very helpful.
You are here to make a submission. She's asking questions. When we are going to deliberate, if she's actually telling you what to say, she's asking you a question to respond. When we are to deliberate, she may then ask those questions to the committee, will be able to interact with her views. I thought we were then going to say, in your own view, this is what I'm trying to say. And you are not helping us. I'm not sure you get my point. Because you are a presenter, she's asking you. Well, you can say that, then I can come up and ask further questions, and I'm sure other members are going to do likewise. And I don't want to speak as a chair on this issue. Dangers in the future. We had heard a very excellent presentation yesterday from Dr. Marik Alpas. I'm not sure she's here. I think she's here, yes, yeah. And for instance, you are saying there are all the dangers in abortion, and she's an expert dealing with all those things now. She's not theorizing about them. In fact, she was even saying that even to know whether the fetus is 10 days or whatever, you don't even need an ultrasound. If you're an expert in dealing with things, not just as a doctor, as a nurse, you can actually know all those things. So that's why I'm finding, you know, normally the submissions help us. I think I said this to one presenter yesterday. I think it was Mr. John Smith, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Submissions are so powerful, these public hearings, because that's where they help us to improve the legislation. Because always they are all, normally my own experience, and I'm sure most of the honorable members here, is that legislation, when it comes from the presentation from the department, gets better when we have the public making submissions. That's part of what we're trying to do here. And you must help us to make it better.
May I respond, Chairperson? Thank you very much. I have to admit that I was under the impression that I'm coming to just be a voice for the people who have put this together and who tried to present it in Durban and it was not recognized. And so we're doing it here in Cape Town, and they phoned me yesterday and asked me to present. So I'm totally out of my depths in concerning discussion and answering the questions, but I'm also learning. So yes, in future if I come and submit something, I will do my research and meet with the people who put the paper together. So thank you.
Need to do the research. I should have elucidated a number of issues for you so that you are able at least anticipate or not anticipate, able at least to engage with some of the questions that we are actually going to raise. I think let's be fair, honored members, and I think we've heard the presentation. We need to move forward.
Thanks, Jane. I was just going to say thanks for that, but I did manage to get, because what I got out of this and other submissions, and in trying to formulate how would I put that into words in terms of when we come to deliberate, because sadly I'm not going to be around, which I'm stressing about. So I've tried to put it here to capture it, and I just wanted to check, so it was helpful just to check that I'm in line with what was meaning there in terms of expressing it specifically for as submissions for our, or proposals for our deliberation. But that was helpful for me. Thanks.
So we proceed to other members. Thank you very much, Reverend, for your submission. Leslie Watson, 15. Leslie Watson. Sorry? Oh, okay. Yes, please have a seat, and then we've got submission number. Oh, yeah, you've okay, that's fine. Do we all have copies? Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chin. I thank you very much for this opportunity to make a submission. I would like to say that it will be rather brief. I just have felt in the last week that I would like to take the opportunity to have my right to present to this committee. I'm a teacher of biology, and I've had much contact with young people teaching biology, teaching about reproduction. I hear the issues, and I also hear of some who've had abortions, and very recently of one who died as a result of a legal abortion. I also represent Meadowridge Baptist Church, which strongly opposes the CTOP Act in its entirety, and I have submitted signatures to that effect. I wish to state at the outset that we strongly support the views and the submissions of the Christian View Network, calling for the repeal of the CTOP Act in its entirety, although I do acknowledge that this is not the purpose of this hearing. And should the government not be prepared to do that, we support their proposed amendments. That's the Christian View Network's amendments. I understand there was much debate yesterday about when life begins, but from the time that the two parental cells join together, a single-celled zygote is formed. That cell has much potential, as much potential to become new life as a 12-week or a 16-week-old fetus. Each one of us started life as that single cell, each one of us, and I want us to think about that. If you snuff out the life of any stage from zygote to blastula, the stage which implants in the uterus, there will be no fetus, no baby. So that single cell has all the potential. Thabo Mbeki, Nelson Mandela, each one of us here, significant people who are debating this legislation, was once a single-celled zygote or a pre-implanted developing embryo of a few cells. We are here because no one aborted our development. We are destroying untold potential of our future if we continue to terminate pregnancies. Each one of us must be thankful that we have the ability to draw breath and live, that no one took the decision to snuff out our life at that early stage just because it was perhaps not convenient. When the proponents of abortion maintain that the embryo is not a living human being, a simple heart begins beating by the 10th day. It's formed as a human heart within a few weeks. A 17-week fetus has tiny hands whose fingers can hold around the umbilical cord. It can suck its thumb, which I saw in my own scan. And that implies that the head, mouth, etc. are formed. And this is a far cry from the unformed mass of cells we like to think of, which ends up in an incinerator. We need to take responsibility for our actions. Society needs to. That an action is possible does not mean that it's permissible. Abortions are available on demand largely to deal with the consequences of irresponsible, uncontrolled behavior among our young people in particular, some of whom have had multiple abortions, so they're clearly not learning. Termination of pregnancy should not be considered a method of family planning, which seems to be the rationale behind proposals which would make it easier to extend the service into the rural areas. All major religions and many traditional cultures value virginity prior to marriage. Our government should be spending more money, I believe, and effort on campaigns to promote the values of purity before marriage and faithfulness within marriage, and on education on family planning. Amended behavior, which would also reduce the number of HIV infections, as has been seen in Uganda, where HIV infection rate has been reduced by a third by a change in societal values led by government campaigns. We should be teaching our people, society in general, that actions have consequences. This act removes consequences of largely irresponsible, pleasure-seeking behavior. This act is the plaster covering over the symptoms of a far deeper problem. If I may quote from the Bible, in Jeremiah 5:22, I made the sand a boundary for the sea, an everlasting barrier it cannot cross. And likewise, God's laws are a boundary for our healthy living. Jeremiah 5:23, people have stubborn and rebellious hearts. They have turned aside and gone astray. Does this not sound like South Africa? God removes his protection from people who reject him. Jeremiah 6:16, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it. It's also written in Ephesians 6:12. Our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers of this dark world, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And these forces of darkness are having a field day in South Africa, ladies and gentlemen. The evidence is all around us. The consequences of our disobedience. Whether you believe in this battle or not, it doesn't alter the truth. We cannot continue to destroy our unborn children and inflict indescribable pain on the mothers due to their lack of knowledge. I'm haunted by the letter written by a young girl who aborted her 20-week-old son without counseling. She was holding a tiny, dead baby of 20 weeks. Not meaning this blob of cells. I believe that was part of a submission by the CVN. But if the CTOP Act is to stand, please consider amendments. We have heard some of them debated this morning. I ask, why does Parliament allow double standards? Just as women have the right to be given the choice to terminate a pregnancy, so too should medical personnel have the right not to perform these terminations if it is against their conscience. And they should not suffer as a consequence of this decision. It's absurd that with our enlightened constitution, this right is not being supported, and much needed trained medical personnel are being kept away from the area of expertise as a punitive measure. Indeed, I believe there's a case dragging its heels through the courts in which a nursing sister is appealing against such treatment. Should abortions be needed, the patients deserve to be treated by experts. We've had some discussion on that already, with specific counseling training and medical training. These procedures should not be performed by nurses to just enable the massacre of the unborn on a larger scale. Counseling prior to the decision to terminate should be mandatory in civilized society. women have a right to know the full details in order to make decisions that will not haunt them with guilt for what they've done in ignorance. There's been some mention of that in by one of our members today. There needs to be adequate monitoring and control of the implementation of the law. I understood that abortions were legalized because it was argued that prior to a certain stage, is it 12 weeks or whatever, it was not considered to be human life. Yet abortions are happening well into the second trimester with no monitoring or control. There need to be guarantees. I believe South Africa cannot hope to be blessed if we continue to legalize abortions and to widen the scale of operations. One just has to look at how society has deteriorated and how it's running out of control since we turned our collective back on God's truth and His way for our lives. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. It was written in 2 Chronicles 7:14. Ladies and gentlemen, we stand at the crossroads. You have it in your hands to choose for all of us. God bless you and give you wisdom.
Thank you very much, Ms. Leslie Watson.
Thank you very much,
members. Honorable Matsimela.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I just want to start by saying God doesn't want to take joy out of our lives. That is number one. And the Bible says He's God of the good and perfect blessings. Now, in your opinion, when a 12-year-old girl is pregnant, do you think that God wants to bless that 12-year-old with a situation like that? Because it says He is God of the good and perfect blessing. Number two, don't you think this amendment are trying to empower each and everyone who doesn't have proper information? That is number one. And again, empower each and everyone who doesn't have or who doesn't have any knowledge on how to access health facilities in terms of Section 27 of the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. My opinion on that 12-year-old girl is that if she's old enough to fall pregnant, she's old enough to have her child. That child could be given up for adoption. That child has a purpose. Each one of us started life as one cell. And we have a purpose, and you have a purpose here this morning. And each one of us has a purpose. We can't just snuff out its life because it's inconvenient. I believe that the 12-year-olds should be empowered by education. They should, I mentioned, campaigns by government to uphold purity before marriage, that we educate our young people that just because it's possible doesn't mean it's permissible or desirable. And many young people are having sex, and we're just kind of plastering over the consequences by taking away the consequences. And I don't believe that should happen. I believe we should be more responsible to our society. There should be better education and encouragement to abstain before marriage. On your second point, we need to empower those who don't have proper information. I think the empowerment, I would agree with you, empowerment is essential. And that's where the pre-abortion, post-abortion counseling, I don't believe has much value. The counseling should happen beforehand so that women have an understanding of what stage of development their baby is, of the procedures, of the consequences. I do believe many women have abortions absolutely ignorant of the stage of development of their baby. And it's already been discussed that there needs to be more counseling and more education of women. I do understand there are many ignorant women out there who do not really understand the consequences. They don't understand, in many cases, how to prevent pregnancy. But I don't believe abortion should be used as family planning. I do believe that we need to educate our population, that they need to be educated to know what, how to conduct their lives so that they are not having these pregnancies. That is my response to that.
Thank you. The question was, you are living in a perfect world, but outside there you know there's an imperfect world. Now she says an event then will arise out of all these abstinences and preachers, etc., where a 12-year-old becomes pregnant. And that 12-year-old, in her own determination, looking at the long-term future and consequences of her future, given I'm not so good in the Bible, the quotation she was actually making, then that 12-year-old is pregnant and wants to terminate in order to protect the good of her, to continue with better education, to be better in society. What would you do in such a situation? That's the question. Not because abstinence has now failed, but the child is presenting to you as pregnant and doesn't want this pregnancy to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I understood the question and I thought I had answered it, that I do believe that that girl should go ahead and have a baby. Many have had children, have continued with their education. 12 years old. They can give birth, they can have a baby. I understand. You know, we find that at school too. Now this is on another track. We find that we try to teach consequences for our actions, for our decisions. We find at school there are parents who don't want their children to have to face the consequences that we dish out. Society is becoming so weak. Parenting is becoming so weak that when people have made a decision, they've acted in a certain way, and there are consequences. We try and remove those consequences. That's exactly what abortion is. We're taking away the consequences. And it's not helping people where young children are having multiple abortions. They're not learning. They're just finding it's very easy to take away the pregnancy. I acknowledge that all those things. My answer would still be that child, that 12-year-old should. I cannot change my answer.
Out from the presenter as to whether he can prescribe or advise us on a contraceptive on family planning methods, which she can propose to us so that health workers do not snuff out the potential lives at the areas where they work. Your presentation under potential of life, you are saying each one of us must be thankful we have the ability to draw breath and life, but no one took the decision to snap out life at that early stage. Now, can you advise us on a contraceptive that can be able to help this health workers?
Well, clearly, once there is a pregnancy, you can't do contraception. The contraception should have happened prior to the pregnancy. And my point is that too many people are falling pregnant carelessly or in ignorance. And we need to make contraception more available, more accessible, and therefore there would be fewer pregnancies.
For the last time, Chair. Chair, on bullet 2 on page, but is the following page of the presentation, why does Parliament allow double standards? There is a sentence which says, should abortion and whatever and whatever not be performed by nurses just to enable massacre of our unborn on a larger scale. Counseling prior to the decision terminate and the stories. Now, I just want to know from the presenter as to whether she is aware that Constitution takes prevalence of any other legislation or right. And Section 36 of the Constitution tells us about the limitations of our rights, meaning that any healthcare worker chose her profession as her own right. Now, in that case, don't you think that the right of the healthcare worker will not, at the end of the day, supersede the right of the user in that case? Thank you.
I think that healthcare workers are trained and employed to save life, and therefore to be using them and expecting them to actually take away life contravenes their right to perform their task that they were employed to do. And from that standpoint, I think that that right should be upheld. I'm arguing for people who have a conscientious objection, and I don't believe that their right should be overtaken, and if it's the will, find some other worker to do it, health worker to do it. But I don't believe that person should be forced to perform terminations against their conscience. I don't think terminations of pregnancy are life-threatening. In other words, you come in with a pregnancy and you're fit and well. It's not that by terminating the pregnancy you're saving the life of the mother. And pregnancies pregnancies are not terminal conditions. So if the health worker did not choose to, if they chose not to terminate it, they would still be upholding what they were employed to do, and that is to save life. And the mother's life is not at stake. The baby's life is at stake. I don't believe that their right should be superseded by the mother's choice to take away life of her child. Constitutionally, I don't know where I'm standing. I must be quite honest. But that is my belief.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you very much, Ms. Leslie Watson, for your presentation. We really want to thank you very much. May we request the consultation of Christian churches? That's number 15. Sorry? No, that's 15. 105 is just some written things here which are not going to have any consequence here. You'll introduce yourself.
Yes, sir.
Reverend.
Thank you, Chairman, for this opportunity to make this presentation. My name I am the Reverend Peter Langerman. I am a minister in the Uniting Presbyterian Church. I'm speaking, though, on behalf of the Consultation of Christian Churches, a Christian network existing in Cape Town, consisting of almost all the major denominations and many other Christian organizations. Our submission is that the scope of the 1996 Act should not be enlarged in terms of more facilities and more staff unless the widespread abuses of the present legislation are addressed at the same time. Accordingly, we respectfully submit that the following clauses drafted by counsel with parliamentary experience should be added to the amendment bill. Firstly, in terms of counselling, sir, this is a fairly long submission. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I shall be highlighting certain issues, if that's okay with you, sir. Firstly, under counselling, that a section should be added: before a medical condition, a practitioner or registered midwife or nurse performs an abortion, he or she shall ensure that the woman is counselled in a manner which provides a full opportunity for discussion and questions, and such counselling shall in every case include, the wording that was mentioned earlier, sufficient information imparted either by electronic pictures, coloured diagrams and photographs to enable the woman to understand the existing stage of development of the unborn child in her womb. B, a discussion of the extent of the risks involved in continuing the pregnancy is set against the risks involved in having an abortion. The latter must be explained in the light of the latest medical science available at the time, must include explanation of the following risks: increased risk of breast cancer following an abortion. I'm actually quite surprised that this has come up for discussion. There are numerous studies which talk about the increased risk. I didn't bring those with me, obviously, but there are numerous studies that talk about the increased risk of breast cancer for women who have had abortions. Two, the risk of depression and associated symptoms after a period of years. And three, the risk of difficulties in conceiving and bearing children in the future. C, the available alternatives to abortion, and in particular the ways in which the state and other agencies will support the mother and child, particularly in the event of the child being born disabled. So we are proposing these amendments because of Section 4 of the 1996 Act, which says that the state shall promote provision of non-mandatory and non-directive counselling before and after the termination. There are difficulties in this section, sir. Firstly, practitioners take the view that the onus of providing counselling is upon the state and not on themselves. Two, non-mandatory is often taken to mean that there is no duty on the practitioner, whereas Parliament's intention must certainly have been that non-mandatory must apply to the woman. She could not be forced to listen to counselling. And thirdly, the words non-directive opens the door even wider for practitioners to assume that if a woman asks for abortion, and any mention of the risks involved might be construed as directive. So the Section 4 is uncertain and equivocal. There is no such problem with regard to counselling a person receiving HIV testing, there's no reason we feel why this should not be extended to a woman seeking abortions too. Secondly, sir, we would like, on the subject of informed consent, we would like Section 5 of the Principal Act to be amended to cover this issue of consent, to read as follows. Save as provided for by subsections 2 and 3 of the section, the informed consent of the woman shall be required in every case before termination of pregnancy is performed, and shall in every case consist of three ingredients: knowledge, appreciation, and consent. Knowledge means that the woman must be fully informed in a manner appropriate to her standard of education, the nature and extent of the risks involved. To appreciation means that she must not merely receive the information, but understand it as applicable to her particular situation. Three, consent means that she must subjectively consent to each step in the procedure and all its consequences. There are more, we feel that there should be greater information provided in the case of a pregnant minor who is seeking a termination, and we're making suggestions there, sir. And also in terms of a woman seeking a termination who appears to be mentally disabled or unconscious. So we are making these submissions about informed consent based on judgment in the Christian Lawyers Association with versus the Minister of Health, a 2005 case in the Supreme Court, where Judge Mojapelo referred to a 1904 judgment in the Transvaal Supreme Court, which talked about what the content of knowledge, appreciation, and consent is, and we feel that that should be applied. We are concerned, sir, about the age of consent. It is our concern that the Principal Act does not adequately address some issues with respect to obtaining informed consent from a minor. Section 5 of the Principal Act deals with mandatory informed consent. Informed consent stands on three pillars: knowledge, appreciation, and consent. We therefore have the following concerns regarding this section. Highly doubtful that a minor below the age of 16 or even 18 will be able to grasp the knowledge of what risks termination of pregnancy entail, not only the termination itself, but also the long-term effects. Two, even if a minor should be able to grasp the knowledge, she most certainly does not have the maturity to appreciate the long-term consequences of her action. And three, the ability of a minor to have a termination without any parent or guardian's knowledge or consent has medico-legal implications in cases where the minor's health is damaged, maybe even irreparably. And those implications aren't addressed by the Act. We are suggesting that Section 5 be rewritten to allow a minor to have a termination only one after two counselling sessions, at least 7 days apart, which counselling sessions shall include a visual presentation of the termination and the gestational age of the fetus. 3, which counselling sessions shall be at least 20 minutes long each. 4, which counselling sessions shall reflect the latest scientific knowledge on the effects of a termination. And 5, with the provision of at least one adult, whether a relative or an official, such as a judge or hospital superintendent. It's common knowledge, sir, that the court is the upper guardian of all minors. In the event of a responsible adult not giving permission, then we feel that the consent of the court should be sought. Fourthly, we are concerned about the gestational age. There is this rather strange provision in Section 2C, subparagraph 3, which allows for termination of pregnancy after the 20th week of gestation in cases where the continued pregnancy would pose a risk of injury to the fetus. We would submit, sir, this is extraordinary, since the paragraph itself implies that a termination will not cause injury to the fetus, and we feel that this section should be scrapped. Number 5, we would like a conscientious objection clause added to read as follows: save in a situation where it is necessary to act immediately to save life, no person shall be under any duty, whether by contract or by any statute or any legal requirement, to participate in any treatment authorized by the Principal Act or the Amendment Act, including any treatment relating to surgical evacuation of the womb, which may follow medical treatment, to which he or she has a conscientious objection on the ground of religion, conscience, or belief, provided that the burden of proof of conscientious objection shall rest on the person seeking to rely on it. There's been some discussion here today, sir, about the protection offered by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Yet seeking redress under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is expensive, it is time-consuming, and it is complicated. And we feel there should be a provision in the Act with regard to conscientious objection. We have some concerns, sir, about the keeping of records, especially records to be kept of third trimester abortions. We feel that there is a gap in the Act here. And then we have our representation also includes a section on offences and penalties. That it is clear that any person should be made clear that any person who terminates a pregnancy otherwise than in accordance with the Principal Act, the Amendment Act, and this Act, or at a facility not approved in terms of the Acts mentioned, without ensuring that the requirements of the Acts relating to counselling and informed consent have been complied with, shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years. And B, any person who willfully prevents a woman attending a facility approved for terminations or in any physical manner willfully prevents the lawful termination of pregnancy shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 2 years. We have some concerns about provisions in Section 10(1)(c) which talk about obstruction. And the Act says that any person who prevents the lawful termination of a pregnancy or obstructs access to a facility for the termination of a pregnancy is guilty of an offence. In practice, sometimes this clause is read by some legal experts as well in such a way that an obligation is placed on the medical practitioner or midwife to perform the termination. We feel this should be made clear. We note with concern, sir, as mentioned, that the Principal Act specifically does not criminalise medical practitioners or midwives who act outside the scope of the Act, and we feel that this should be addressed. That, sir, is the crux of our submission. attached to our submission is an article headed Abortion Causes Mental Disorders, a New Zealand Study, which was undertaken by a pro-choice researcher, which yielded some interesting results in terms of the long-term effects of women who have undergone terminations. And there is a short bibliography at the end of that relating to some other studies, which I didn't include for obvious reasons, just too much space. But we have included this article because we feel it is interesting and will be helpful to the committee. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Shepherdson. On the first page of the presentation on counselling, I just want to make the presenter aware that there is a National Health Act in the country. And that National Health Act on Section 4.3c says, all persons except members of medical aid schemes and their dependents and the like and the like. At the end of it, it says even women who want to perform CTOP should have an access to healthcare facilities. When you further go down with that act on Section 6, it speaks about user to have full knowledge. It means counseling will take place in that. And Section 7 of the Act says the user should consent at the end of the day. Now, I just want to know as to whether around this issue of counseling, the Act doesn't cover your concern. Thank you.
Can I answer that? I thank the Honourable Member for the question. I think the issue is, whose responsibility is this? Where does the onus lie for providing counselling? And we feel that this is not clearly stressed in the Principal Act nor in the amendment. And we feel, notwithstanding the provisions of the National Health Act, which I take and I understand what you're saying about that, but notwithstanding those provisions, that there should be a clear stipulation in the CTOP Act where the onus for counselling lies. Because at the moment, the buck is being passed. The state is passing it to the medical practitioners, and the medical practitioners are passing it to the state. And the ones falling in the gap are women who are not receiving adequate counselling prior to this invasive and, in some cases, life-threatening procedure.
Thank you. Just around the counselling situation, you mentioned the use of the word non-mandatory, although you clearly saw it not being in terms of the person counselling, but the person being counselled. Now, that in itself, I agree with you, it still makes it sort of an ambiguous situation and it's confusing. But I want to just ask, in terms of it being the counselling being non-mandatory for the woman or the girl herself, do you find that problematic? And I think here, for example, in my oversight role on with the health committee, I have gone for 2 HIV tests over the past 8 years. And I'm very aware, and I think it's excellent, that I would not get away with not being counselled. There's nothing non-mandatory about that counselling. So my thinking there is, if it can be mandatory there, would it be different here? And if I'm going to have an operation of any kind, is it possible that I can refuse to listen to what the consequences are, because that surgeon would not do that operation? So I'm just wondering how you see that. Is this word also perhaps problematic in that sense?
I think the issue for us has to do with the Original Act and trying to understand Parliament's intention with the Original Act. Clearly the words non-mandatory were in the Original Act and are still there. Our attempt has to understand why those would have been included. I agree with you that it is anomalous that you cannot undertake an HIV test, for instance, without counselling, but a woman could have a determination without counselling. So that anomaly is taken, and as the Honourable Member mentioned earlier, this might even be in conflict with the National Health Act in some ways. But our attempt is to try and understand why the Original Act said and held that this was non-mandatory. And our conclusion is that it could only apply to the woman herself for whatever was in Parliament's mind when they passed that legislation. It could not logically apply to the practitioner.
Maybe just we will need just once and for all clarify this particular provision. We did attempt yesterday to deal with this particular issue, because the Reverend here is saying that non-mandatory is taken to mean that there is no duty on the practitioner. Whereas the Act, I don't know where you quote it, it says the state shall promote. I'm not sure you're quoting it right. Let me check it myself. The state shall promote the provision of non-mandatory and non-directive counseling before and after the termination of pregnancy. Now you are saying here, whereas Parliament almost certainly intended to mean that a woman cannot be forced to listen to abortion. I mean, to what? To counseling. I don't understand that conclusion. Where do you arrive at such a conclusion? And then you then say a non-directive opens the door even wider for the practitioner to assume that if a woman asks for an abortion, any mention of the risk involved might be construed as directive. How do you come to those conclusions?
So, as you've asked about Section 4, I think it's a good opportunity for us to think about Section 4. Section 4 of the Act, the Original Act, says the state shall promote, not provide, but promote. Well, what does it mean to promote? That, I think, is sufficiently vague for us to have questions.
Encourage.
In what sense, sir? Does the state circulate information? Does it train? Does it provide education for healthcare people in government healthcare facilities? I think I'm a fairly well trained person. I don't understand what the word promote actually means.
Right, in conjunction with the National Health Act.
Granted, sir, that's
an overriding act that amended the 1997 National Act.
I take your point,
that
sir.
That actually specifies now even further the rights of patients and all those things. You are well informed. I'm sure you could have referenced.
I take your point. However, as you know, sir, in terms of the interpretation of any statute, you interpret the statute in the light of its it stands on its own. So we must be able to interpret Section 4 in its in itself. We must be able to look at section 4 without any ambiguity, understand what the state is meant to do. And I submit to you, sir, that if you read section 4 in itself, you cannot understand what the state is meant to do. But flowing from that, there is a confusion when it comes to the actual implementation of this, about on whose shoulders the responsibility rests to provide the counseling. Now again, as has been mentioned, there is no such confusion when it comes to HIV counseling. Everybody, this is applied and has been applied in a almost more controversial area, if I can put it that way, because it affects more people. But it's been very clearly stated and very clearly implemented and well implemented. We are involved with some training of HIV counselors in our congregation, and they are trained by people who are contracted by the state to help people to counsel those coming for HIV testing. We are simply asking that the same be provided by the state for women wanting to undergo terminations. We're not seeking to be controversial here, sir. We're not seeking to muddy the waters in any way. But I think Section 4 does need to be clarified as to upon whose shoulders this responsibility rests and who bears the onus for providing this counsel. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, I think you're trying to be disingenuous, I think, in the way you are trying to respond to this question.
Well, sorry,
let me just pursue this thing, because I really want us to rest this particular point here.
Yes.
I'm sure you'd know this, and I'm sure you've made this particular very eloquent claim here. But I'm sure any statute or legislation in Europe that is in Parliament is not just read in its own singular entity. Is cross-reference with the Bill of Rights, with the Constitution, and then the ambit legislation currently that rests all any other health issue is a National Health Act. Question of concern, keeping of records, all those things. I'm sure you have read the setting of it. You have read the National Health Act here. Can I just ask? Now I'm not going to allow you, Honourable Dudley. I know what you're going to say. No, I'm not going to allow you because I want us to rest. I know what you're going to say. Yeah, you see the problem that always frustrates us in dealing with these things. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm sure you can look at all of us here. We all go to churches. We're all involved in these things we're claiming to be involved in. Ourselves, our families, our communities. And you're not just alone in dealing with these things. We know. And please, when you deal with us, don't put yourself on a pedestal that we think you're the only one dealing with. We ourselves are dealing with these things. We work in our communities. So it's always important when you come and present to us, that pedestal, put yourself, but always be modest enough to know that people you are talking with it are not ignorant in dealing with these issues. Always very much important. Because the way you are putting it here now, this is a subjective interpretation of the legislation. That's an unfair approach. I'm sure there's a state law advisor here, there's another legal person here, the other people. And I'm sure that we can actually come to this issue and clarify it once and for all. But always move from a humble point of understanding that not only you who's dealing with these things, we deal with them ourselves.
So if anything in this presentation has suggested in any way that I have not regarded the members of this committee and members of this parliament as people who are capable and highly intelligent and very involved in these issues, then I apologize unreservedly. That certainly was not my intention in the slightest. My intention was for us to present to you some concerns on behalf of many of the churches and Christian organizations in Cape Town. But I will come back to Section 4, sir, and I will take issue with any state law advisor who is sitting here to say that in interpreting a statute, the courts will look firstly to the wording of that section itself. And they will ask themselves, does this make sense? Is it clear, standing on its own, what is the responsibility of the organ of state that is mentioned here? And I submit to you, sir, as I've said before, that if you look at section 4, it is unclear. It is slightly vague. And I believe that could be quite easily cleared up with a small amendment.
Honourable Dudley, I know you're itching to speak if I was going to pursue this.
Thanks. I'm wondering if it wouldn't help, and perhaps ask you. We don't, unfortunately, have the clause that's in the National Health Act in front of us. That would be better if we did. But if we did, and if that did address the issue, then my thought was, would you say then that perhaps if we made reference in this Act to that particular clause, that would actually solve the situation?
It's a slightly difficult question to answer because I obviously don't have the Act in front of me. But if it would help bring clarity, I think anything that would help bring clarity would be useful. So if it might help to bring clarity, then I think that might be useful, yes.
I can't remember I was making this presentation and they wanted us to put what was in the regulation with regards to the post. I think I can't remember what they put. I think Chris, it's not Justice Alliance of South Africa. Am I right? I think JASA. And if my memory serves me well, and I'm sure I'm going to ask people from the department to clarify this, is I want us to rest this. And I've said this earlier on, and I think the eminent person here is going to appreciate this further, that the legislation stipulates certain things, but you don't want verbose, long legislation that have become a Bible that people can't even read. The Bible becomes the regulation that the public participates, and I think the term frames are stipulated. That's where then you're going to say, this is what the Act says, there shall be the promote mandate, non-mandatory, non-directive counseling. That's what it will say. And then the regulation will further elucidate on what it actually seeks to say about these things, not the legislation, because that's where practice is. Because the regulation now puts the regulation puts legislation into practice. Can I ask the people in the department if there anyone who's aware about these regulations around the specific issue? Because I really want us to put this into rest, because I know that this thing presenting is wrong. Okay.
Thanks, Jefferson. It is indeed correct what Honorable Member Matsumela said relating to the responsibilities and rights of users. The National Health Act is an overarching legislation for health. The rights and responsibilities of users and providers equally apply to all in all circumstances where users have come to request health care services. And in this regard, if a user comes requesting termination of pregnancy, the provisions of Section 6 will equally apply to such a user. And with regard to the wording of Section 4, it is very clear that the responsibility lies with the state. So anyone who is in the employ of the state in providing termination of pregnancy, that person will be requested or required to provide the things that have been specified in Section 6 of the National Health Act. And also maybe just to take this opportunity, Chairperson, to state that the wording of Section 4 is different, or would have been different, if it was reading like the state shall promote non-mandatory and non-directive provision of counseling. But the wording here says it shall promote the provision of non-mandatory and non-directive counseling, which means there shall be counseling, but that counseling is non-mandatory and non-directive. So it's completely different to the way it is being interpreted here now. Thanks, Jefferson.
Just on clarity then, with this, the CTOP Act says non-mandatory, which means that people don't have to have counseling if they don't want it. Is that correct? It makes it non-mandatory.
Thanks, Chairperson.
it says here the responsibility is on the providers to provide that counseling. There shall be counseling before and after termination of pregnancy. The non-mandatory and non-directive wording refers to the fact that the providers should not impose their subjective views on the person requesting termination of pregnancy. There shall be counseling, but it shouldn't be directive on the part, it should be directive as to which choice the user should take from the provider.
That's why the state shall provide. The state shall provide. You carry this shall promote the provision, the provide. I'm using the word provide carefully. It's there. It shall promote the provision, you shall provide. It's there. I mean, I know what I'm saying, I'm talking about. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Well, then, if that's the intention of the legislation, we should take out non-infantile mandatory. Then, because that creates all the confusion. That gives the impression, as I read it, that a woman going for, or a girl going for an abortion doesn't have to have counseling. It says non-mandatory. That's what it means in English. Non-mandatory.
Well, I'm not going to enter any more into the English. I think we've clarified this over 2 days now. Once again, as I said then, and I want to further say, non-mandatory, non-directive, specify to how you provide. What is it that you want to carry? So that we are not putting your own subjective views. That's what it says. Don't put your own subjective views, but provide this counseling. But if Mike Waters doesn't want this, has got a subjective opposition to termination, not even abortion, it's termination of pregnancy choice. The operative word here is choice. If you don't want to accede to that, then but indicate these are all the information. For instance, what it says here, you can actually see the subjectivity. When it's actually present, give photographic things, do this. You're already giving a particular direction if you do those things. But a medical practitioner who is actually more objective in these things, these are all the consequences that are there, but take your own decision as a patient. Thank you very much. Any other question? Honorable Matumis?
Yesterday we have that abortion causes cancer. Now today, with your annexure, you are saying abortion causes mental disorder. I just want to find out as to whether there is a study that has been taken in South Africa where, despite what you are giving us about New Zealand, is there a study or a confirmation that women who underwent abortion suffered mentally a disorder?
I'm not aware of South African studies. I'm not aware of extensive South African studies on this whole issue. Certainly this is not my field, but I did do some reading in terms of preparing the submission. So there could be studies of which I'm not aware, but I'm not aware of extensive South African studies, certainly not long-term studies. And you'd be, I really want to point out that the New Zealand study was taken over 25 years. Our exposure to the Choice and Termination of Pregnancy Act is not that long. I can just mention anecdotal evidence, which certainly is not a study, but I have dealt with a number of young women who have been severely traumatized through terminations. But I'm not aware of any long-term South African study, no.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to bring this to your attention that abortion did not come with the present democratic government. It has been there before. So it is years in operation, more than 25 years. And most of the people who used to benefit from it are those who used to fly abroad to go and do it. Because our people were poor, they could not. That's why they resorted to backstreet abortion. And this is why we are trying to avoid, to make it legal in South Africa.
Even in South Africa,
sometimes people come and present to us here. It's sort of an affront. You know? We have seen and witnessed people bleeding in front of us at schools. When we were young ourselves, in our township schools. Whites never get all these facilities. This now presents us with an opportunity to say, give a choice to women. If you want to terminate, do. If you don't want, don't. Choice to women. And then it specifies all the other rights. I just want to clarify just this thing. I just want once and for all, once again, because I just want us to move forward in terms of dealing with this. There's page four of the submission. I'm not sure, maybe Dr. Professor Mhlanga or Dr. Alblas, you're going to clarify. And I think we did get Dr. Alblas' submission, although it was verbal, I hope we've taken notes, members. Section 2C3, the after 20-week process would pose a risk of injury to the fetus. That's put in quotes. And then you scrap there for this particular provision because it would have to be, you have to evacuate the fetus from the wound via a cesarean section to prevent injury from a continued pregnancy. Now I presented here that section 2C only provides cesarean, and I wouldn't think it's only cesarean, that only a cesarean method can unnecessarily deal with section 2C3. I don't think it's necessarily true, but I'm not sure if Dr. Alblas, Professor Mhlanga, or both, you can elucidate on this point. And then we'll get the doctor to, or the reverend to respond.
Wrong one. Okay. Well, it can be done by cesarean section, but that is a last resort, I think. I think what is usually done, I personally go up to 20 weeks. I don't do above 20 weeks. But I know that you can give medication to get contraction of the uterus and the woman is expelling the fetus. That is normally what is being done, and I think that Professor Mhlanga will agree with that.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'd like to concur with Dr. Alblas. The issue above 20 weeks, I think as was stated yesterday, that above 20 weeks in South Africa, according to the Principal Act, that child is now potentially viable. And therefore, any birth or the delivery of that child is considered to be now potentially in the notifiable conditions, and therefore that gets notified. And the primary way indeed of ending that pregnancy, terminating that pregnancy, is through induction, which means that we give some products that we can either put in the vagina to soften the mouth of the womb and then give another drug to cause the contractions. Or if that fails, or if it is an emergency to save the life of the mother, for instance, where she has had fits because of severe high blood pressure, but she said 21, 22 weeks, then she would be taken to theater and where a hole is made in the uterus to take out that fetus. Now the second aspect of that termination after 20 weeks to prevent injury to the fetus, is that if then you detect that there is fetal distress at 24-26 weeks, then you terminate the pregnancy. But you terminate the pregnancy in order to prevent the baby from being subjected to further damage. So you take the baby out and then you put it in the incubator, in the nursery, then you are able to care for that baby well outside the mother's womb, because that environment of the mother's womb was not friendly for that baby. So that is why the Act says to prevent further injury to the fetus after 20 weeks. It is actually indeed to save that baby, to be able to care for it afterwards. Thank you.
So you said earlier, you talked about giving a fright, and again, I want to say, if anything I've said or in this presentation has caused a fright to any member, yeah, I apologize for that unreservedly. It's not been my intention to give a fright or cause offense in any way. Under the gestational age, on page 4, we are specifically talking about section 2C3, which, as has been pointed out, deals with continued pregnancy posing a risk to injury of the fetus. And we feel, sir, that this is really quite strange, as has been pointed out. At that stage, the fetus can be removed from the womb and will be probably viable. But we're talking here about termination of the pregnancy. We're not talking here about giving birth to a live fetus. We're talking here about terminations after the 20th week, as far as I understand the Act. Well, then with the deepest respect, that is completely indistinct. That is completely the wrong impression created by this section through you, Chair. I think then, because the implication of this as I read it is that the termination, that the pregnancy is being terminated, i.e. that the fetus has been destroyed. That's the implication of it. And then, given what you've just said, I don't see why it should be here. Then it can be taken out, because we're talking then about a viable human life. And the argument for scrapping this section is then even stronger.
The definition of termination of pregnancy says means separation and expulsion by medical or surgical means of the contents of the uterus of a pregnant woman. So, can we get a school girl? Thank you very much, Reverend Langman.
Thank you, sir.
Can we get a school girl? They are not here. We proceed, Honorable Members. Where? Oh! Sorry? I'll be the last person people are scared of me. I'll be the last person people are scared of me. I can guarantee you that. School girl, where's your presentation?
We thank you for the opportunity to make the submission. Sorry. We thank you for the opportunity to make a submission on the amendment bill. We thank you, we, the young women of the listed high schools who have written our names and signed this submission, ask for special consideration. It is to us that this legislation is directed. It is our business. We have most to gain or lose. Consider our submission while as you are preparing laws that directly affect our lives. We ask to be heard and empowered. This amendment bill is to improve the CTOP Act of 1996. It allows us to have abortions. We would therefore implore you to look at the following. Informed consent. We have to make a decision, sometimes alone, yet we have not been told of the risks. We have heard that women have suffered from pain, infection, injury, psychological disease, guilt, suicide, sterilization, and sometimes have even died. We have not been told of all the risks. We need to know exactly what the risks are. We ask you to correct the amendment so that people who do the abortions are compelled to tell us exactly what the dangers are. We find it strange that you will not let us buy cigarettes because of the danger to our health at the age of 14, yet you let us decide to have abortions without telling us the damage it could do. One abortion is surely much worse than one cigarette. We have not been told the truth regarding the development of a baby. The abortion clinics have misled us by telling us the baby is just a blob of tissue. Please give the amendment bill strong penalties and fines to discourage clinics from misleading us. Freedom of conscience clause. Some of us want to be nurses and doctors, and we do not believe that committing abortion is right. Yet we have heard of nurses and doctors who have been forced to do abortions against their will. We feel this is most unfair in a democratic country, and we need to be protected from future exploitation. Please put a clause on the amendment bill to protect us from being forced to do anything against our conscience.
Thank you very much. What's your school?
I'm CVC St. John's.
Where?
In Parkland.
Where?
CVC St. John's in Parkland.
Oh, okay. What grade are you?
6.
Wow. Jeez. Yeah, you're very good. Public speaking, you're not to be scared. Congratulations, I must say. Indeed, I'm impressed.
Must I give this to you? Or?
Yes, I'm impressed. Well done.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to, she was saying you're going to be trembling and what, you are so powerful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you. What's your name?
Natasha.
Huh? Okay. Thank you very much, Natasha. Yeah. Thank you very much to Natasha from the school in Parklands. Very good confident presentation. I think that's what you must take out of all this. I think I'm very much impressed personally. Can we go to presentation by Healthcare Christian Fellowship of South Africa, Erika Groenewald. Healthcare Christian Fellowship of South Africa, Erika Groenewald. Not here. Didn't we have Christian Junior talk to one another? Yes. Okay, who? Okay, sure. Oh, it was Christian Action Network. Now it's Christian View Network, and my sincere apologies. No, that's what I'm being clarified here. Yeah, Christian View Network. What is this? Loose copies. Why? What? Eh? Where are the copies for? Maybe this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to comment on this proposed amendment act. I'd like to start off by giving an outline of what I'm going to discuss. Firstly, I'd like to look at the proposed amendment act from the point of view of four different categories of people. Those are the unborn, from the point of view of God, from the point of view of the health workers, and then from the point of view of the mothers who are involved. And then afterwards to discuss some alternative positive amendments, which I think previous speakers have already argued for, but I would present further arguments in favor of these positive amendments, which could be made as an alternative to what is being proposed in this act. And then also to comment on some of the questions which were raised by some of the members of Parliament to the previous speakers, which were discussed. Firstly, to look at it from the point of view of the unborn themselves. I think that there has been some focus on some of the different people involved, but I think we must not forget that the primary people who are affected by this legislation are the unborn. Now, it was commented by one of the previous speakers that a 12-year-old child could be affected by this, and I think that the stress on the 12-year-old is because the age of the person puts them in a weak position. And I believe that the unborn are in an even weaker position, and they are even younger people, and therefore even more deserving of our protection. They are defenseless, unable to speak for themselves, and so far 650,000 have been killed. This act, by self-admission, says that it will increase the number of babies that are aborted as a result of widening the number of places that will be doing it and the ease of access to this. Then, secondly, looking at it from the point of view of God. Now, I think this is something we must not leave out, because the scriptures teach us that the unborn are created in the image of God. That is exactly the same motivation that we have for the argument in favor of racial equality, that even though we may look different, we are all made in the image of God, and therefore we are equal. The same argument is used in favor of the unborn. They are made in the image of God, and therefore they are equal. Now, just to illustrate very briefly why this is something which affects God is because, as an example, there was an incident a few years back where some people in the military started doing target practice at photographs of politicians. Okay, and that included photographs of President Mbeki. Now, quite understandably, the politicians were outraged by what had happened here, including the president, and I think there was some discipline of the soldiers involved. In the same way, killing an unborn child is an attack on the image of God. Now, I think if people are afraid of what the president being angry, I think there's also good reason to be afraid of God being angry about this killing of these unborn children. Then thirdly, the impact on the health workers. There are two ways in which this impacts on health workers more than the 1996 legislation, and that is firstly by the deregulation into smaller clinics where there is a smaller amount of staff, and secondly by the deregulation to allow nurses and midwives as well as doctors to perform these abortions. Now, there were already a lot of abuses under the 1996 legislation where health workers were being coerced into assisting with the performing of abortions against their will. I've personally had many people contact me to address those situations. In many cases they were being intimidated, in some cases they were being refused job applications, and in most cases they were in very, very weak power positions, especially nurses, and pushed to do things against their will. They were not in a situation where they were wanting to go to court against the health authorities and then risk possibly not getting another job from the health authorities, because most of the health workers in this country are employed by the Department of Health. Now, the Department of Health gave an argument at the time that the 1996 legislation was made that they initially put in a conscientious objection clause into the 1996 legislation, and then at the last minute they withdrew that conscientious objection clause and deleted it. And the argument that was given at the time was because they said that the Constitution gave the right of conscientious objection automatically, and therefore it was completely unnecessary to state that in the legislation. Now, there are a number of problems here. Firstly, we hear from one of the honorable members the interpretation that is completely the opposite of what the health department gave in its explanation in 96, saying that the constitution limitations now put an obligation on a health worker simply because they choose the profession to assist with abortions. Now, this is a total 180-degree turnaround in terms of their position. And it distresses me to hear this. I don't believe that the Constitutional Court would support that interpretation, but unfortunately there are many voices that are communicating that viewpoint, especially certain feminist groups. And I believe it is necessary to clarify this, both because of the fact that there is misinformation on the interpretation of the Constitution coming forth from a especially these feminist groups such as Women's Legal Center, and secondly because there are so many recorded instances of the abuse of health workers in the implementation of the legislation up to the present. And if that was the intent of the health department, then we would ask them please to state it very clearly that they do have the right to conscientiously object. And if a nurse is put under pressure, she can go and show the legislation to the doctor who's pressurizing her and say, no, I don't want to do this. And we'd be happy to put forward in our submission some specific wording for the way that it should be worded. We believe it should include all health workers, not only nurses, because there are many other administrative workers and such like who are involved in the process who do not want to be involved in what they're doing. Now, just to clarify, the most common way in which this abuse is happening is in the administration of the drug Cytotec or misoprostol, where a health worker who is in favor of abortion prescribes the drug and then goes off duty. While that person is off duty, the woman comes back again, having then had the impact of the drug and it causing abortion, and then a pro-life health worker who does not want to be involved is forced then to finish the procedure. So that is also a reason why we would oppose this deregulation into smaller clinics, because it's going to put more pressure on those people. They do not have, in most of those smaller clinics, sufficient people, even if one supported this legislation, to actually do that in a consenting way. And there's no provision here to ensure that there are in these smaller clinics actually people willing to do that stuff, and it's inevitable and it has been happening on a routine basis that there is this coercion happening. It was also a note the Nurses Union has put in an objection to this amendment bill in the 2004 submissions. Then, going on further to the interests of the mothers, the mothers are in many cases people who are in a situation of distress, often put under pressure by powerful male figures in their family or in relationships, and they very often regret the decision at a later stage. We would oppose abortion in general, but even for people who would support abortion and arguing in favor of women's rights, I cannot see why they would oppose the mandatory provision of information to those people and the specification of the information that they need to hear. Because the complaints that we have heard from women are, for example, that they did not know about alternatives, they did not know where else to go, they were not given information, certain basic medical information about the development of the baby or shown photographs. And if they had known about these very small bits of information, which are not difficult to communicate and could even be put into a pamphlet, then they would have made a different decision. So I would challenge anybody here who is maybe even in favor of abortion to explain why that is so difficult to do. Unfortunately, the wording of this provision on counseling, which is put there at the moment, does not specify that what information needs to be provided. In many cases, we've been told, for example, that they are simply asked, well, why do you want to have an abortion? They say, well, because of this reason, and then they are just encouraged by the medical worker, yeah, that's a good reason to have an abortion. And in that way, private doctors and medical clinics make money. In many state hospitals, there just isn't a lot of resources to do even many other basic medical procedures, and so the doctors see counseling as entirely superfluous and low priority, and so it just doesn't happen. So we would argue if certain simple information would be just included in a pamphlet and somebody could talk them through the information to make sure that they understand it, that could make a big difference to a lot of women's decisions and would also save a lot of babies. And I believe that can be argued irrespective of whether a person is in favor of abortion being legal or not being legal. That is a simple thing to do. Just to clarify this proposed wording, the state shall promote counseling. With all due respect to the chairman, I respect his interpretation and I wish that everybody else would share his interpretation of the legislation, but unfortunately on the ground most people are not sharing his interpretation, and if he can do anything to persuade all those people on the ground that his interpretation is correct, I would very much appreciate if he would do so, but at the moment it's not happening, and I believe that a more clear wording which we have proposed in our submission, which includes certain information which needs to be communicated, which can therefore be verified by a court to see whether it has been done or not, because a vague obligation of simply the state promoting counselling, it's not clear that there's an obligation on the individual health worker to do the counselling or to see that it's been clarified that it's been done before they actually perform an abortion, and so they can always shift responsibilities to somebody else. They cannot be found guilty of not doing that by a court. And yeah, I mean, somebody can just keep passing the buck and saying, well, the Minister of Health should be doing this. So there's no complete responsibility on that to be done. I would also draw an analogy in between two different types of rights that are recognized widely in law. The one is commonly referred to as red rights, which are, for example, people shall have a right to housing. Okay, but now the problem is that you cannot go and claim that right to housing and simply go to the government and demand, I want a house now, because it's not an absolute right. It's simply something that the court has interpreted to say that the state should on an ongoing basis try to address the housing problem, but somebody cannot demand a house as an absolute right today. I want one. Otherwise I think the government would have a very big problem on its hands. But in this instance we don't want something which is just a general obligation on the state to promote something gradually and over a long period of time. We want certain minimum basic information communicated as an absolute requirement, and if that is not done, then somebody needs to be able to be taken to court for breaking the law. And that has been done in many places overseas, and it has been substantially helpful in reducing the number of abortions and the number of people who regret their decisions later. I don't see why the South African legislation, either in regulations as the chairman proposed or in this law, can not make such regulations. I think one could put a general statement into this law, and then maybe we could discuss putting some of the parts of it into the regulations as Chairman Sumkuli has suggested. But yeah, I think that is very practical. Now, in general, this so-called choice on termination of pregnancy law, I believe that's a euphemism. It's not an explanation of what is actually happening. Is wrong. It is the killing of 650,000 innocent babies. We have an opportunity now to turn back this killing and to stop it, or at least to reduce the number of babies that are being killed by introducing, for example, these proposed amendments. But in general, the 1996 law is wrong. I think we had reference to it being legal on a more restricted scale for 25 years by one of the honourable members. I would add to that is also wrong. It was wrong in 1975, and it was wrong much more so in 1996, and this is even more wrong. So the wrong is measured not by what is being done, but by the number that are being killed. We're talking in the 1975 law between 600 and 1,000 babies being killed per year, but we're talking in the current situation of more like about 70,000 being killed per year, and all of those are innocent people. So I would argue for the repeal of the entire 1996 Act. Although I understand that is not the purpose of this hearing, and if the current parliamentary committee does not have the mandate to do that, they can at least use their powers to make some amendments to the Act, and I would suggest scrapping all of the proposed amendments which are in the bill that we're looking at the moment, and putting four or five alternative amendments. The first one in favor of conscientious objection, as I've previously discussed. Then secondly, in favor of informed consent and information. That is informed consent, not just consent, but informed consent, making sure people understand what they are agreeing to, because many people say later that they don't agree to that. Then thirdly, the protection of born alive infants. We know there have been incidents of babies who have been born alive and simply left to die instead of any attempt being made to look after them and help them to survive. And this is very tragic and sad. Then fourthly, there's the issue of parental consent for minors, as with any other procedure. Well, there's been many tragic situations where children did not have the opportunity of getting the advice of their parents because they were taken off from school counselors to the medical clinics and given secret abortions, and the parents were completely horrified later, and the children were sadly persuaded in their moment of crisis by the school counselor who thought they were doing something good. Then fifthly, to criminalize partial birth abortion, which unfortunately the South African legislation doesn't have any prescription against. That, for clarification, is the killing of a baby when it is halfway through the womb, essentially by inserting a pair of scissors into their neck to suck out their brains. That is, there's no law against that in South Africa, and I believe that there should be a law against that in South Africa, and I would hope that there would be nobody here who would support that practice, although it is unfortunately not illegal. Then, lastly, having looked at these different amendments, I think, you know, I would argue on the one hand for Parliament to do what is in their powers to do to try and mitigate the damage here, but I would also not want to understate the seriousness of the wrong that is being committed in the legalization of abortion in general and the duty on all of us to speak out against it. We have had the recent history where there has been many people who have put false confidence in thinking that they are safe in what they're doing because they think that what they're doing has the support of the state, and not too long afterwards they have found themselves on trial for having done something wrong. And one can look, for example, at certain people who were involved in activities and in the apartheid era who thought that they had the protection of that government. That government disappeared and they failed to apply for amnesty. They thought they could get away with things, and now suddenly they find themselves in court. We also have had certain parliamentarians who have been thought that they were safe in abusing their travel budgets, and they have landed up in court. And I would argue very similarly that this action is breaking God's law, and those people who persist in this, unless they seek God's forgiveness, will end up before God's judgment seat having to give account for what they are doing. And I would urge those people to please consider that the government will not be there to protect them in those instances, and they will have to give account to God for what they are doing. I hear that certain members are attending church, and so I would say even stronger reason to consider what the scriptures have to say about these things, and to consider the question of coming before God's judgment seat and how they will defend themselves. Now, I know of two instances where leaders in the pro-abortion movement, including one in South Africa, have accepted God's forgiveness and realized that they have done something wrong, and they have repented of that and turned around and gone against that, including somebody who was involved in the drafting of this 1996 legislation. And I would encourage everybody here who is involved to realize the seriousness of what is happening, and that the government cannot protect them from God's judgment, and that there is a duty to speak up for the innocent in this situation. So, in conclusion, I would urge everybody to look at this legislation through the lens of the interests of the unborn, through the interests of God, in the interests of the health workers, and the interests of mothers, all of whom are being harmed by this legislation, to do everything within their powers to work against this legislation, and if it cannot be immediately and totally repealed, to instead work towards positive amendments such as conscientious objection, informed consent, the protection of born alive infants, the parental consent for minors, and also the criminalization of partial birth abortion.
Thank you very much to Christian View Network for your submission. Members, questions? Honorable Matsimela.
Chair, I just want to check with the following in relation to the presentation. The presenter has made mention on page 2 of section 3, subsection 3A. Now, I just want us to read this section, subsection, where with 1A and J has been mentioned in his presentation. Now, my question would be as follows. Because immediately thereafter, there is this sentence which says the deregulation of the requirements and the like. I just want to know from you that don't you think that with this deregulations of powers to provinces, number one, will actually affect what we call service delivery? Because out of it, I think that there will be an increase of a pool of more trained nurses. That is number one. Two, don't you think again that with all this, it will increase an accessibility of women to have terminations more earlier? Because when you look at 1A, it says gives access to medical and nursing staff. That is the number one question I've asked you. 1J has telephonic means of communication. Now, don't you think that this will increase accessibility of women to this healthcare facilities? And lastly, Chair, it's around more risk of error by healthcare workers. There is a sentence which says, nurses are less well-trained than doctors or midwives. Now, this amendment says, before, only a trained midwife was allowed to perform CTOP. Now, it says, this amendment says, a trained registered nurse is also allowed to perform these procedures. That is what is within the amendment. What are the wrongs in that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Just to clarify, I think if you're measuring service delivery as an increase in the number of abortions that are happening, yes, you are correct. That provision does increase the number of abortions that are likely to happen. It also, although firstly we would argue that that is not a positive, that is a negative, because that is more babies that are dying. But even if one did see that as a positive, then there is the problem that the deregulation, putting these events into smaller clinics, which are less well equipped, is going to increase the number of women who are injured by abortion because there are less backup facilities. And secondly, it's going to increase the number of healthcare workers who are coerced into doing this against their will, simply because you need to have, in order to not coerce people against their will, you need to have 24 hours staff there that are in favor of abortion and prepared to perform this stuff. So if there's three shifts, you would need to have at least three. Now, many of these healthy workers, these smaller clinics do not have that number of staff that are in favor of abortion at all. One also has the problem of just private doctors dispensing misoprostol and then sending people off to the health clinics to go and have the procedure completed. So then also to answer the question about training, I would argue that a nurse is not equipped However well trained the nurse is to deal with the complications that can arise as a consequence of abortion. It is a serious medical procedure. A person can lose their fertility, they can die, all sorts of things can go wrong that are very serious that a nurse is not trained to deal with, and it's necessary to have somebody who is who's well trained for that purpose. One does not allow nurses to do numerous other medical procedures which are the similar level of risk, but it seems that for political reasons and not for medical reasons, because of some people who for whatever reason just want to have more and more abortions happening everywhere, this is being deregulated in a way that is not in line with the rest of the medical practice. Similar also with consent for minors. The minors are not allowed to go and have medical procedures without their parental consent on pretty well every other issue, but on this issue they make an exception for political reasons. So I would oppose that both for moral reasons and for medical reasons.
You indicate that there are somehow discriminations between babies born prematurely and those that were born in terms of medical care, and she's getting perhaps. I'm referring now to specifically a baby born a life after forcibly terminated pregnancies must be entitled to the same protections and this objective would demand if it is born out of effect, if you say there are discriminations between a baby that's born premature and a baby that has gone through term.
Perhaps there was a misunderstanding there, and maybe it was my fault for not making it clear enough, but to clarify that question, there is a situation where certain babies are born alive after attempted abortions where the use of the drug misoprostol induces premature labor, but the baby is not born dead, the baby is born alive, because misoprostol doesn't necessarily actually kill the baby, it just expels the baby from the womb. So the discrimination then is between those babies that are born alive as a result of accidental premature birth and those that are born alive as a result of abortion, that the care that they're receiving is different. And in many cases, the babies are simply left to die in the hospitals without being given even adequate warmth or whatever. They're just left in a cold room to die. And so the wrongdoing of this legislation in practice is extending beyond simply the womb, also into after the babies are born, they are not treated equally.
Notwithstanding, I think you've listened, I'm sure, I saw your city there. When Professor Mshanga was actually explaining the actual meaning of termination of pregnancy, it seems as if we are still having a very wrong conception of the understanding of the term termination of pregnancy. In the way you are actually responding to Arab materials.
I very much.
Dimensional understanding of termination of pregnancy. That's what has been gleaned by your response now to the question.
Okay, can I respond to that? Okay. I would argue firstly that this act should not be called the Termination of Pregnancy Act. It's a vague term, it's a euphemism, it doesn't really have an accurate meaning. Every single birth is a termination of a pregnancy. I was born as a consequence of a termination of pregnancy, and so were all of you. And that this act is has a meaningless name which is meant to hide what is being done. It should not be termed the Termination of Pregnancy Amendment Bill, or even less the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Bill. It should be termed the Killing of Unborn Babies Bill. And that is the wrong that is being committed and which needs to come to an end. That is what is happening here. Now, with all due respect to the professor, I would be very happy if everybody else shared his interpretation of that particular clause, and I wish that would be the case. I've never heard it before, and it would seem to me to be more likely to be interpreted by those who want to kill babies in the womb as an excuse to kill a baby who is maybe handicapped or some sort of situation. But I think that I would be very happy to propose some changes to the wording which could be included in this amendment bill, which would clarify that issue and support the interpretation of the professor and also of the chairman, Mr. Nkuli.
Mine is on the interest of the unborn.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that when you say we should reject this amendment bill, we will be going 100,000 feet back for women of this country to go back to illegal abortion in the back? Don't you think so?
Well, I'll answer that in several different ways. The first answer to the question is rejecting the amendment bill would still keep abortion legal because the 1996 Act would still allow it to take place at places, but not with nurses doing it and not at these other smaller medical clinics. But I would also fully support the repeal of the 1996 Act and also the 1975 Act for exactly the reasons that I've stated previously, that this is the killing of innocent unborn babies, and it's not in the interests of the woman. I also remind the honourable member that she was also at one point an unborn baby, and that 50% of the 650,000 babies are also women, so that makes 325,000 women who have been killed as a consequence of this abortion law. Statistics from other countries, although they're not available in South Africa, indicate that the vast majority of abortions where screening is provided of sex are of female babies. So that is a major discrimination against women. In fact, much more serious than I think any other form of discrimination against women, where parents often who want a male child who's going to earn more and support them in their old age prefer to have a male baby. And in fact, in many countries, especially places in the third world, and where there's a poverty situation, but there is this screening choice, there has become a gender imbalance to the extent sometimes that a lot of men have difficulty in finding a wife because there is a statistical gender imbalance in the population. For example, China is a major country that creates other social problems. But I would say this is a more serious discrimination against women than any other form of discrimination against women that's around. It's also a myth that women are in general in favor of abortion. The statistics even of the ANC membership of their own female supporters shows that the vast majority of them are opposed to legal abortion. In fact, even more so than in amongst the black population than in the white population. Generally, women tend to be more compassionate towards children. They want to protect them, they want to keep them, they want to look after them, whereas usually it is the man who does not want to have to provide for an extra child, who does not have to support his girlfriend or wife in an unwanted pregnancy. He pushes her into having the abortion against her will, and that is another form of gender oppression which we would oppose. Thank you, Mr.
It's 1 o'clock now. I'm told in the same big chat, you go out, left, right, straight down. I think that's where all of us are invited to lunch. We come back at 2. Thank you, sir. Yeah? No, please, no waiting to say.